Good morning and welcome, everyone. My name is Sherry Hills, and I'm the Acting Manager of Research at the Ontario Media Development Corporation. Thank you for joining us for our final Digital Dialogue Breakfast of 2016 and our first ever session in London. We're very happy to be here. I'm sure most of you know about the OMDC, but for those who don't, we are an agency of the Government of Ontario. Our mandate is to stimulate employment and investment in Ontario's creative media industries and to help build strong companies in Ontario that can compete on the world stage. OMDC offers programs and services for the film, television, magazine, book, IDM, and music industries. My thanks to our local partners today, the London Economic Development Corporation, thank you, on London, thank you, and for supplying Hubert, our volunteer today, and for the London Music Office for their assistance in delivering this event. I'd also like to thank our board member, Adam Kaplan, who's here in the audience, and for your help in organizing the session. Adam is the founder of Webisodes, a London, Ontario-based company that produces social video for interactive experiences. Previously, Adam was the creative director at Cineplex Digital Networks, executive site producer at the home shopping networks HSN.com, and for over a decade has lectured on e-commerce strategy at Western University. Adam currently serves on the board of directors at the Ontario Media Development Corp. And here in London, Adam has served on the board of directors for the Grand Theatre, Museum London, the Digital Media Collective UnLondon, London's Mayor's Economic Council, and Emerging Leader Sustainability Advisory Committee. Please join me in welcoming Adam, who'd like to say a few words before we begin.
Thank you very much. And actually, this is like, I've got an analog thing going on my iPad right now. I'm very excited about that. Just want to welcome everybody. Thank you so much for coming and taking a Tuesday morning to join us here. I've been working with the OMDC now for just about 3 years, and it's been a remarkable experience. The agency is really a profound gift to Ontario in terms of what it's capable of doing. And it's a lot of really amazing people doing amazing things for other amazing people in the creative industries in Ontario. Not just in digital, but obviously music, film, all the screen-based industries, books and publishing and magazines. I think a lot of people know OMDC for its tax credits and for its grants and for a few other things, but I think one of the things that I've been most profoundly impressed by is the research and the other services in terms of knowledge sharing that the OMDC provides. And one of the things that has been most beneficial to me is to recognize that London is part of a sort of a provincial success story in digital creative. And, sometimes we feel like we're out here in London and we don't get to hear all these things. And I love that OMDC has brought this here to London. I was actually a twin version of this in Toronto a few months ago. You're in for a treat, this panel is a marvelous group of people. If you're not, I think most of the people in this room are familiar with AR and VR, and for you, I think that this is probably part of a continuing conversation. And what I wanted to kind of get up here and halt this all to say is I hope that this is sort of an amplifier for that conversation, both locally and provincially, and that we can continue to have these conversations about emerging technologies, what we can do in London to continue to be a part of that success story across Ontario and be a part of a provincial collective that is improving digital creative quite literally globally. So I'm not going to say any more. I'm just going to let these guys get back to it, and I'll welcome Sherry back up. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, Adam. And today's topic is exploring the value chain of augmented and virtual reality content creation. We're going to examine the world of augmented and virtual reality, a sector that's anticipated to grow by a staggering 89% by 2020, when the industry is projected to be worth $16 billion globally. I'm pleased to introduce our moderator this morning, Nigel Newton. Nigel's a consultant for AR innovation and strategy, having previously worked at companies like Layer and Blipper Canada. He recently worked on Oz, world's largest location-based VR experience, which launched at Fort York in Toronto this past summer. Also on an AR exhibit for Canada 150 at the Art Gallery of Ontario with Mayhew Digital and with Indy on their broadcast AR solutions that will be installed at the Toronto Zoo and the Montreal Biodome. Nigel is also a frequent commentator and public speaker on immersive content. He's recently presented at the Canadian Music Week, DigiFest, IAB, and CERT Center events. Please join me now in welcoming Nigel and our four panelists, Bernie Roll, Keith Maskey, Demir Sloger, and Dr. Rhonda Bathurst. Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. So before we get started with the panel introductions and get going, I want to learn a little bit more about you. It's a great opportunity for us to extend into the digital community, and we understand from Sherry that we have certain partners that have led to the audience here this morning. But I was wondering if you'd be willing to share with us, with a show of hands, just how many people here are from, say, the gaming community? And how many people are in content development of other kinds in digital media? And then in publishing or books, and in music and other forms of recorded entertainment. Lovely. So we now get a good sense of who's here. So we're going to try and make our address to you in terms of what our experiences are, so that we can both inspire and inform you about the world of augmented and virtual reality, so that we can give a sense for you, so that you can go back to your place of work or study and determine how augmented reality and virtual reality fit into your world and your future. So on that basis, just another quick show of hands, how many people have had a head-mounted display experience, other than the ones today? Okay, so a large number. And how many of those have been fully virtual reality immersive experiences? Great, excellent. So we're dealing with an educated crowd here, guys, so this is good. So the other component that I'm really interested about is how many people here, and Bernie, I think, will be interested in seeing this, how many people here regard 360 video as being virtual reality content? Okay, excellent. All right, so I think we're going to get a level set. So I'm going to go from my left across to the right. So Keith Maxey. Keith is the CEO of Red Meat Games. Rhonda Bathurst, Dr. Rhonda Bathurst, beg your pardon, is the executive director of the Museum of Ontario Archaeology. And then Demir. Sloger is the CEO of Big Blue Bubble. And Bernie, I'm always torn whether to talk about your commercial exploits or your work at Western.
Do both.
Do both. There you go. Bernie is a game developer who's specialized and focused in augmented and reality software development for a very long time. Released a game which you may have seen here today, Escape from Bunker 14, which was on the Samsung Gear, and is currently working on an HTC Vive version of the same game.
Which is quite a bit different and quite a bit longer and more involved and so on, yeah.
There we go. In coming here today, one of the things that we have really focused on is exactly what it is that the future looks like, and in terms of trying to look at where we're going next. Each one of the panelists today has a different kind of experience and background to that perspective. So we're going to ask them to share some of their insights along the way. And I think Sherry had mentioned earlier that maybe we're going to have the questions at the end. Great, if you can just think about those questions and hold them to the end. If there's something really burning and you feel you really want to explore more, don't hesitate. This is an interactive event, so raise your hand and wait for the microphone, and we can address those things as we go. I'd actually like to start with Rhonda. Now, Rhonda represents our client. She's a little bit of an educated client, would you say?
A little bit of an educated
client.
Archaeologist by training.
So. Right. So you came from the Sustainable Archaeology Unit.
Yes.
Where you were looking at how to use digital and emerging technologies to interface for research purposes and the public interface with artifacts.
Yes.
Now, the key thing that we're really interested in is this development of the Longhouse VR experience. Mm-hmm. As a kind of client and potential operator, and you can maybe explain a little bit about what's going to happen at the museum, what was the fundamental thing that drew you to virtual reality as a proposed interface for the public?
For the public in particular? Is the mic okay? Everyone can hear me? Okay. So
if you can come a little closer, yeah. I think that would be... Or just move the mic.
That's
great.
So I did spend 7 years next door at Sustainable Archaeology, which is a Western facility, a research facility. It's designed to house a lot of archaeological artifacts, millions of archaeological artifacts from across southern Ontario. We have a very deep history here in Ontario, a heritage here in Ontario, that upon delivery, we seem to fail a little bit in terms of making that exciting or interesting or knowledgeable. How many people know that there were people living here in southern Ontario in the London area for 13,000 years? So this is the sort of thing we want to share with the public a little bit more. What can we do to make that a little more interesting? I've worn two hats. So as a researcher, that's a challenge to make things interesting to the public. But really, as a researcher, you're interested also in making it relevant to other researchers. As a new museum hat on, how do I actually make that relevant now to the public? So as I spent 7 years learning about digital technology and how to store things better, how to keep them over the long term, what sorts of means we can use to deliver that product. So not just in a digitized database, but as an image itself. We can make 3D scans. How do we deliver those to other researchers and get a little bit of information out of that? What can we do once we have a digital 3D scan of something beyond putting it in a database? What do we do with it? So we started to explore different ways of utilizing these digital assets, putting them into virtual reality construction. So we had a virtual reality longhouse early on. An internship came in and did that for us. And we found it was interesting to be able to pick up these scanned artifacts. It gave people the ability to pick up something that had been digitally scanned and then use it. So they didn't have to pick up the actual object itself. And going from that into a public sphere, I was interested in providing that ability to the public. So stuff at museums, there's so much in archives. There's so much you can't touch. You walk up to an exhibit, it's behind glass. I want to be able to put that into people's hands, make it more engageable. And I had learned next door there were interesting new ways of doing that. So one of the first interesting ways I felt for public interface was the HTC Vive that we got. We had the Oculus first. So these goggles, these immersive goggles, in which we could take the sorts of scanned images we were working with, or at least the environments that we were talking about, these maps that we work in two dimensions with, could be built up in three dimensions and put them in that sphere. I thought it would be interesting for people in the public sphere to be able to engage with it as well. So it's great for researchers to engage with. It provides talking points for researchers, a new dimension for us to work in that we're not used to working in. But for the public as well, it's a more engageable experience, a more interesting experience that they feel immersed in and they feel a part of, as opposed to standing and looking behind glass.
Now, so when you sort of were down this path, you mentioned you started off with Oculus Rift. Mm-hmm. What was the path that took you down towards HTC Vive instead of the Oculus Rift? What was the decisive factor there?
For us, in terms of we're on a grant and we have a set amount of time to purchase our equipment. We were on board early with Oculus as a development kit. But coming to commercial time, our grant is ending. Timeline, got to spend our money. An Oculus was available, but it wasn't coming out. It was, as anybody who's bought an Oculus or been involved in that purchase, they staggered that end date when it was coming out. HTC Vive popped in out of nowhere, really, and it was providing the same product. So for us, it was a fortuitous opportunity to get something we knew we would have by the end of grant. Oculus, we weren't so sure. And as it ended up, I'm quite fond of the system.
Now, Keith, as a developer, you had this Bloxic game that you'd been doing in collaboration with a game developer, and you saw an opportunity to port that game over to a virtual reality component. Tell me sort of what was the thought process, similar to sort of Rhonda's, in terms of kind of the development path and choice. How did you go about deciding which interface was the most appropriate?
Yeah, so with Bloxic VR, basically... having already had the HTC Vive, the developer's kit, and the Oculus Rift, we were really just breaking down the gameplay for what the course of actions are that takes place in there. So just in case of anybody, most people probably haven't seen it, it's basically an interspatial 3D puzzle game. So it's like taking a Rubik's Cube and adding puzzle elements into the cube itself. And just the natural motion of using the Vive controllers, where it's very physical, you have that sense of agency of being able to manipulate the world around you, we said, well, this seems like a natural fit, where I can actually reach out and rotate rows and columns of this sort of big cube puzzle. And so just the ability to engage in that way allowed us to really just take that game and port it over into the HTC Vive. We also ported it over to the OSVR. They came on board and they said, hey, that game looks pretty good. Would you mind doing that for us? So we did that for them as well. But it really was the simplicity of the right now, because the market is so early with both the technology for the headsets as well as the physical controllers, that for us it was just that simplicity of, well, the Vive controllers are out and the touch controllers were coming out in October and we were working on this in the summer. So it was just the timing was right.
So Bernie, the whole that'll happen intermittently. Don't worry, it's no attempt to give anybody any side effects. So if the lights flash, don't worry, it's not us trying to keep your attention. One of the things that we were talking about in the run-up to this was how the emergence of the PS4 as yet another platform has its own set of parameters. We've heard from Rhonda and Keith about the reasons why they gravitated towards the HTC Vive. What can you tell us about the PS4 as a platform and how it differs to that?
Yeah, I mean, generalize that a little bit. I mean, you have all these different VR platforms, all the way from Google Cardboard through Gear VR, PlayStation VR, Rift, Vive, and so on. So you have a lot of diversity / fragmentation in the market, and each of the systems has its own strengths and weaknesses. Certainly mobile VR, things like Gear VR and Google Daydream and so on, are great because they're portable. If you want to go somewhere and give a quick demo, awesome. You can carry it around anywhere, and they're inexpensive for people to use, so you reach a very large market. Things like the Rift and the Vive, great experiences, really awesome experiences, but they require a high-end computer, so it's a much smaller market, but a better experience. So there are trade-offs all the way around. PlayStation 4 and PlayStation VR are kind of in the middle, in the sense that the PS4 is not as powerful as the kind of computer you'd have with a Rift or a Vive, and the resolution isn't as high as the Rift and the Vive, but it's more affordable, so it's a little closer to the mobile space that way. So it's very interesting. I haven't myself yet done any development on PSVR. Keith's company has, so he can give you more insight into that process. But I think it's good that we have a variety of systems at a variety of price points, because I think that'll help raise the visibility of VR generally.
And Demir, you and I both have context for the augmented reality world. We talked very much about the virtual component here so far. Big Blue Bubble went into a development co-venture with Spaces and Microsoft to bring Singing Monsters to the HoloLens. What was it about that that proposition that most interested you as a game development company?
Well,
you may need the microphone.
Sure. I think the number one thing, it was just a cool thing to do. I think everyone, I hope everyone still remembers the scene from Star Wars when Chewbacca and C-3PO playing this holographic chess, and that's something you can actually do now with Microsoft HoloLens. That's the only platform that will allow you to do something like that. So we thought that will be amazing thing to incorporate actually characters from our brand into the real world, and we team up with Spaces. Spaces, by the way, is company founded by DreamWorks that recently got acquired by NBC, so it's kind of whole different set of story. And we work with them to develop this for Microsoft HoloLens that we don't know when it's going to be available, but when it will be, it's going to be very cool. So I think this coolness factor was really the main thing for us to do this. We don't see, at least not in the short term, maybe not in the medium term, being huge market opportunity for us to continue developing content for it. But being first on a platform as big as this, I think it will be really good for us.
So Demir, not only just the coolness factor there, though, there was something about the Singing Monsters character that lent themselves to being rendered in that environment. Can you kind of describe what it was about that potential to interact between the audience and your character?
Well, yeah. First of all, there's a huge audience that already exists for My Singing Monsters, and also audience is really across all the demographics. So for us, it was really good to showcase this. For Microsoft, it was really good to showcase also the HoloLens is something that could work for everyone, every family. So Microsoft actually created really, really good video that I will encourage everyone to check it out. When you can interact with our monsters in a 3D world. So I think it was just really, really good fit, not just from the brand itself and the product being Microsoft HoloLens in this case, but also from our idea of what we want to achieve in the end.
Right, and I think that this is one of the components which is really important in terms of augmented reality and virtual reality development is understanding what you want the outcome to be. Mm-hmm. Keith, when you went into this proposition of developing cross-platform, so you've gone into HTC Vive, you're now developing for PS4, you did OSVR. What is the kind of core component that you need to keep in mind as you begin to develop experiences with, that you want to focus on as outcomes?
Well, I would say that there are two major parts to it. One, just from a development perspective, is figuring out what the lowest common denominator behind all the technology is and making sure that you're developing specifically with that in mind so then you can scale up, because scaling down is so incredibly hard to do after the fact. But then the other part was breaking down all of the different controllers so that we were focusing on how does the PlayStation VR work versus the Vive versus the Oculus versus OSVR, and creating the different controller landscapes for each one of those different devices. Because Oculus Rift, I can play with the touch controllers, but if I don't have that, then I can play with gamepad, and if I don't have that, I can play with the mouse and keyboard. So it all depends on the actual experience that you're also trying to portray. So we're working on a game right now called First Impact Rise of a Hero, which is, I like to call it a superhero simulator. Basically, we allow you to fly and jump and run in all kinds of superheroic ways. And in that one, there's a series of different controls that we created using gesture-based recognition. So we have certain gestures that you take. So if you want to fly, you would put your arms out to go and fly like Superman. And then there's different other ones that we have in there as well. And breaking everything down to figuring out what that core experience that you want the player or the user to go through, I think is the primary reason why you spend so much time figuring that part out. Because if you don't have that part nailed down, the experience will muddle itself over time. And so that to me was the most important thing that we could actually get down is, what is the experience based on the controllers, based on the inputs, so that you had clear consistency behind or between all of the different platforms that you're working on?
Now, Bernie, one of the things that you have looked at in terms of your own game development with the virtual escape rooms is that in those environments, you actually have a challenge that responds very well to being in a dome, in a 360 environment, is that you have to look around, you have to find things, you have to then progress from space to space. Did you have a particular technique that you had in mind in trying to create that experience when you first set out for Gear VR? Or did it kind of like just naturally evolve out of the medium?
Well, I think I started from having played a lot of real-world room escape games, and I love that genre. It's a lot of fun. And I thought it's a really good fit for VR because it's very different from what's out there right now. What's out there right now in terms of games are a lot of horror-based things or zombie shooters, and I think there's definitely a place for all of those, but I think having too many of those and not enough of anything else is a problem. And so I wanted to do something that not a lot of people were doing that still was a good fit for the technology. That's why I focused on room escapes. And there is something compelling, not so much in the Gear VR version, because you're limited by only having rotational tracking, not positional tracking, but on the HTC Vive version of the game, it's very compelling to be able to walk around, pick up objects, interact with things. People get very engaged by that. And so I wanted to provide a lot of things in that environment that they could interact with and engage with. So finding interesting puzzles to solve and interesting objects they could use in the solving of those puzzles is one of my goals.
Demir, that sort of notion of kind of creating that environment of involvement, within the sort of general landscape right now, there's solo player games and then there's multiplayer games. When you look at the landscape of whether it's on a PS4 or if it's on the HTC Vive, Where do you see that there is most potential coming out now in terms of game mechanics? Is it in multiplayer games, or is it in sort of more in-depth role-playing games where you get more immersed into the character?
Well, definitely, I don't think we can talk much about multiplayer games, considering the fact that it's such a small user base for each of these platforms out there. So creating a game that's focused on multiplayer just wouldn't make sense today. Probably even a couple of years from now, I think it will be so low in terms of install base, especially on the devices that are fairly expensive, that really single-player, very, very immersive game is the way to go. As long as you can lock your room, making sure kids don't enter your room when you in virtual reality or getting distracted or something like that.
Right, and it's interesting because you then identified that the need for space. So, Rhonda, you've just recently kind of begun to explore this. You've identified a space at the museum. What physical considerations did you have to kind of think about when you were making the selection of your space at the museum?
It was actually, we were lucky we had a room already, so 12 by 12, that had been an old office. So we decided.
For HTC Vive.
Yeah, so for the Vive. So that was great. So in order to put the Vive in, perfect opportunity, but then you run into some issues with tethering that we've experienced, we all experienced.
So how did you solve that issue?
Laundry cords, really. So we hung them up. So, and I'd encourage anyone who is interested, come check it out. It worked out quite well. My husband, bless him, he came up with the idea to off of YouTube videos. So a lot of people are trying to find these hacks.
Right.
And these hacks just pull the tether up. The tether is a limiting problem with this sort of technology.
So you need to remove the tether so you don't have a tripping hazard on the floor, right?
Yeah. So we just elevate it in these extendable cords. So you can still have it on, walk through the space, and they extend as you move through the space. And you're not tripping over the cord in this space. And you don't need somebody behind you lifting up the cord. But one of the limitations we have with this game is, as well, is we have to have an attendant. You can't just leave somebody on the game. You have to put them on it and watch them and make sure they get through it and make sure they're not tripping over anything and make sure there's some sort of engagement there. So what's lacking for us is that structure of you walk into a game, here's the contained 3 to 5 minutes of the game, the experience, and then an exit point. So for us, you're walking into a digital longhouse, you're experiencing the digital longhouse, and it's up to now an attendant to draw the narrative for them and then pull them out of it again.
So on that basis, Keith, and narrative is really important in VR because you lose the ability to direct the user. So tell us about what you've done in terms of your superhero game. How are you able to create the game construct so that it allows the user to get going into the environment?
So one of the things that we found that you can't do that you would normally do in a video game is necessarily is in-game cinematics. One of the challenges is that you can never take away the player's ability to look around and interact with that environment. However, there's a couple of different ways to do it, but you still have to allow the player the free will and the agency. You can't take away control of the camera, for instance, from the player. But beyond that, what we've done is we've taken from traditional gaming environments, we've created sort of mission-based content. So you're told you have to go to this location. You get a mission from somebody. We do it in dialogue bubbles. Reading is kind of difficult in VR, but we've worked out a pretty simple system to provide dialogue for the character or for the player to actually interact with and figure out, okay, this is my mission. I have to go over to this place. So it's all done through these sort of mission-based narratives that we're building. And then there's a lot of the backstory that gets filled in by doing that. So it's more along the lines of sort of an older school RPG where you're actually doing a lot more reading than not. We actually did toy around with whether or not we wanted to do voice acting for the game, but we just found that there were too many limitations, and we really wanted to focus as much of our time and resources on the gameplay as possible, as we recognized that there was a lot of experimentation that was going to have to go on in the game. So we made some, I think, smart choices that way. And it still makes it feel like a comic book because you're going up to somebody and you see a comic book bubble, dialogue bubble pop up. So it makes it feel very much in that genre of being in a comic book.
So did you have to approach storyboarding and scripting differently to create that?
Not Not overly much, actually. What we found instead is that we had to allow freedom of the player to approach these people who give you story and mission from different angles. So we actually had to allow for, say, the dialogue bubble and the character who gives it to you to face the player, right, and look at the player at all times, or not in some cases. We had to allow the player to be able to walk around while they're reading this bubble. And how do we do that? So in Bloxic VR, we actually developed this information panel that allows you to walk around your cube, but then the information panel will always follow with you.
Right.
So we're doing the same thing with our dialogue bubbles that we're doing in here. So then that allows for people to walk around and still be engaged in that environment, but still get the information that they need.
So how many people here within the room have studios or content development or developers who are working in either Unity or Unreal? So what I want to do is just touch base on this. Unity and Unreal seem to be the common denominators for the augmented reality and virtual reality development. Mm-hmm. Rhonda, you started out with an intern developing an environment.
Yes,
was that was built in Unity?
That was Unreal.
In Unreal.
We started in
right.
that. Yeah, and now it's been, it couldn't be ported. It had to be developed into Unity, yeah.
And the choice for moving over to those platforms, do you have any idea?
Unfortunately, yeah, not. Right. Not
Michael
Carter,
Carter.
Yeah, and yeah. Ryerson. So it's his PhD. It's his PhD research that he did. And I think part of it was informed on the sort of technology that was available. He'd come out and tried the Vive and the Oculus. Originally, what we'd done, we'd ported into Oculus, yeah. So the early version was an Oculus, and he found that there was limited capabilities, I guess, but really in the end, the decision came down to him, and I'm not entirely sure what informed that.
Mm-hmm. And Demir, when you were porting over the content with Microsoft, what rendering platforms did you use? Was it specifically a bespoke Microsoft interface?
The whole engine is our proprietary engine for this particular game, so what Spaces help us with is just do the rendering part, so basically, rendering for the HoloLens was done for this, but all the game logic and everything is done in existing engine, because this engine is now, like, I think, more than 5 years old, 6 years old almost.
So, Bernie, just generally, we have this opportunity to be able to knit things together that have existed in the past and use Unity as a kind of blender to output stuff and publish to different platforms, right?
Right. I've used Unity for a number of years now. I've looked at Unreal from time to time. Unity has a lot of support for VR. Every time a new device comes out, day one they have support in Unity. And then at some point, Unreal, and then maybe other engines. So I don't envy you if you have your own proprietary engine, because you have to then write support for each new device you want to use. Whereas Unity, you have that support right there. And you also have a lot of people using it, so getting questions answered is very easy. You go online, and someone has run into the problem you're running into right now, and they have a solution. So that's the advantage of being on a platform that a lot of people are using. But I think they're both valid platforms. Actually, I'm curious about something. Of those who are developers here, hands up those who are using Unity, Unreal. Wow, yeah, it's pretty clear. Yeah, so if you're doing any kind of VR development, for those who are listening to the podcast, a lot of hands went up for Unity and like two people for Unreal. So I think that's where the trend is right now. But 5 years from now, who knows? There could be some entirely new solution.
And also just getting flavor from the audience as well. I mean, how many people have got projects in development right now in Unity? And how many people are actually looking to publish those projects and are looking at how to get them into an audience? There you go. So I think that's also that's for the purposes of the podcast, a lot of people have projects under development in Unity, and I think in the room who felt comfortable saying that they were trying to seek an audience.
I should have put my hand up for that.
You should, yeah, very true. I mean, I think this is very indicative of where the industry is right now. It's a fast track to development of content. But there are very few people who are beginning to sort of test the water for audience development and consumer response. Now, Rhonda, you're just about to launch into that world of consumer response. What are you anticipating setting up in order to get feedback about the experience from people who go into it?
Excellent question. Very right now, very analog in terms of asking for experience. We figured we'd have a little brochure. Somebody could fill out a little brochure at the end about it. But talking to some of the folks here on the panel, I think we can probably do a little bit more in terms of what we can actually track. I hadn't considered, for instance, tracking things as to what particular... Is there a particular handheld device that they like to use? Do they like to use the handheld devices? Is there a particular way they react to the walls when they come along to the side of the walls? So actually having somebody there, so having probably the attendant that's watching them, I'd like a little bit of feedback as well as to how people are actually reacting to the game, because there's their feedback, it's somebody's feedback that you can pull information out of, but it's also observing them and trying to see things they don't necessarily realize that they're getting out of it as well is an interesting challenge. So I'm going to go back and revisit how we're going to do that, actually.
And if I could just add another idea, is analytics are great because you can keep track of exactly where in the experience people are spending their time. I mean, in the Longhouse, which I've seen, actually, I've been to your museum, it's quite impressive. The Longhouse, I can see people going in there and just staring at the fire for the longest time, and not experiencing anything else. So knowing that, you might want to find ways of saying, something's over here, come look at this, right? And crafting the experience to match what people are actually interested in and guiding their interest to other things.
Now, Keith, you've published games already. You've got them into Steam. What are you doing and what can be done to draw people's attention to your games once you publish them?
Oh, marketing. there's so many different areas, and especially now in VR, there's still so early again in sort of the platforms that there's so much ability to make good connections with a lot of the VR-specific outlets that are out there. Probably one of the biggest ones is Upload VR, and they're looking for all kinds of content. One of the things that we did this year is we actually started playing around with mixed reality, where we actually took our superhero game and recorded myself and a few other people playing it while on a green screen behind us, so we could actually have us in the world playing it, and then on the green screen showing exactly what you would actually be seeing if you were an outsider looking in. So it was a way to really kind of, like I say, the mixed reality between the virtual reality and reality. So it's a great way to do that. And Upload VR, for instance, does a lot of these videos themselves, but it's a way that we can actually differentiate ourselves and put out something different. One of the other things that we did this year as well is because of the, again, early stage of the technology is we took the game, because it is a comic book themed game, we actually took it around to comic cons all over Southern Ontario and into the U.S. a little bit. And so, first of all, it's a Vive. It was a huge draw for that alone. It's a comic book themed game. There's not very many out there. And the ones that are out there typically have a major IP attached to it, such as Batman or somebody else. So we had all these varied interests coming into it. So it was a great way for us to actually build more of a grassroots level of a community behind the game. And it allowed us to do something that was very different from what other companies actually do for their getting their game concepts out.
Right. So that's within this sort of rarefied home download use. People are going to be in their homes. They're going to have their headsets. They're going to be downloading the games. In terms of public access, though, I mean, these games now are getting into arcades. And I don't know how many people have seen Waterloo has set up a virtual reality arcade. Control V is the company. Anybody ventured out that way yet? No? Okay. Bernie, I know that this is very close neighbor to where you're set up.
It's from where I live.
There you go. What was interesting when I drove through Waterloo yesterday is that they had a street sign that said virtual reality arcade open, gift cards available. I was actually driving in there, but they're not open on a Monday, just in case anybody's going to take the drive up. They're closed for administrative reasons to reset after the weekends. But what's fascinating about that space, Bernie, is that they are completely 100% focused on VR. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no... there's a Pac-Man stand-up old arcade game just as a diversionary thing, I think, sort of give you a touch for the old school. But other than that, it's all VR. What considerations does an operator in a public environment have to give to a virtual reality, augmented reality experience?
I think it's a great question. And it's really important because I think a lot of people's first experience of VR is going to be in something like a VR arcade or a museum or a library. It's going to be some public venue because, again, the hardware is very expensive. A lot of people aren't going to shell out that much money to buy a system until they've had a chance to try it. And so I think that's the value of these public facilities, whether public in the sense of, as I say, libraries, museums, things like that, or virtual arcades. And I think it's important that people who go to these have a positive experience, an experience that is going to be comfortable, safe, and so on. And so I'm actually involved with something called the VR Standards Board, which is a nonprofit that's designed to create a set of very basic guidelines for any kind of public VR facility. Things like cleaning the headsets between users, things like having an attendant nearby, things like having content that isn't going to make people nauseous, right? Things like that, those basic guidelines will help people, I think, have very positive experiences in VR and will eventually lead to a growth in the home market.
So in the background to this arcade, is there any infrastructure there that they've created to manage that experience?
Yeah, they've done, I think, a really good job. Like, I've met the guys a number of times and spoken to them. I think they're really on track to having something very successful because they are putting thought into all these issues. They're thinking about how do we make this an easy-to-use experience. They have a video you watch before you go in and use it that explains everything. It shows how to put on the headset, how to use the controllers, and so on. So you don't have some human attendant having to give that same speech hundreds and hundreds of times. You have a nice, slick, well-produced video that says, here's how you do it, and people watch that, and they now know how to use the system. Within the environment, they have a kind of launcher where you can choose what experience you're going to have, and it's not the Steam launcher, it's their own custom experience that they built. It's very easy, very natural. So I think they're putting a lot of time into that kind of thing. And they've also worked with other organizations. Kitchener Public Library, for example, is using the launcher that Control-V developed. So Control-V is very good about being community-friendly and kind of giving back. So I think all of those things come together to help create a good experience for people.
So Kitchener Library is renting out games? How does that go?
Loaning
out games, I guess.
I'm not sure what their business model is, but they have a facility in Kitchener at the library where you can go and use the Vive, and I know they are using the software that Control-V created.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, actually, I was just talking with the Kitchener Public Library. They actually, all you need is your library card, and you sign up for 20-minute time slots, and I think they have 5 or 6 different game experiences to select from. So it's all very simple, and it's pretty much like easy to run, exactly like what Bernie is saying. So it's self-administering.
So now we're looking at price. The arcade, they sell the experience by the hour, I believe, right? And duration. Like, what are these? What is the typical length of an experience right now? I mean, in terms of gameplay, I mean, is it like 90 seconds in and out, go on to the next one, or is it like an hour?
Yeah, it varies. I mean, how long is the Longhouse typically?
We expect 3 to 5 minutes people right. will spend in that tops.
Yeah. So that's a shorter experience. The one I'm working on, the Room Escape, is aimed to be about 40 minutes, maybe an hour, somewhere in there, like a real-world escape game. Whereas for longer format, I think Keith's company is doing a lot of stuff in that area.
So we're aiming for the 3 to 5 hour range for ours.
And the HoloLens experience, what's the typical kind of experience meant to be there in terms of duration?
It's not really a game. It's right. a more interactive experience. It really depends. I consider this to be now in a almost demo stage. So a
couple of minutes will be really optimal, I think, because it is more as an introduction right now.
Right. Now, when you look at the time and duration, is there a relationship between duration of experience and the price of that experience? There's a huge range of prices. There's a lot of free content, which it may be a reason why it's free. And then there's free content, which is very compelling. And then there's the tilt brush for HTC Vive, which I think is now $62, $65 download. So how do you price up something for to in commercial presentation?
Well, we've actually done a lot of work on this with First Impact, where we actually had to take a look at a lot of the content that's out there. We've downloaded a lot, played a lot, got grossed out by a lot, just with the price points. Like, one of the biggest ones that has hit the market over the past couple of weeks is the Martian experience, taking place from the book and the movie and putting it into a game interactive experience. Yeah, the Matt Damon movie, and where, you know, the world has to spend billions of dollars to save Matt Damon again. so anyway... it's a 20-minute experience, and they want $20 for that.
$20 US?
Yeah. So it's a very high price point, and this is what people are actually kind of complaining about, where I can go see the movie, which is a much longer experience, for only $10. Why would I want to spend $20 on that?
Now, isn't this, Bernie, where the arcades come into this play, right? I mean, because now there's a rash of arcade or people being opportunistic and setting up units. IMAX is doing an agreement with Starbreeze headsets to introduce them in Los Angeles and in Manchester, England. But then there's a kind of like a there's an interstitial zone where there's a bunch of operators coming in, buying an Oculus or an HTC Vive, and then charging people for games that they've downloaded just for their own cost. What's going to happen within the ecosystem to protect the gaming developers in this scenario?
Right. Obviously, game developers are only keep developing games if they're making money from them. I mean, that's the reality. So we need to make sure that the game developers are being rewarded for their efforts. Again, mentioning the VR Standards Board. One of the requirements is that the games be properly licensed for public use. So if you're going to, for example, spend money on spend $20 in a game and then let everyone play it for free, well, obviously that developer is then losing out. So we have to have some way of giving them some revenue from that. And there are guidelines for that as well. In terms of how much to charge for an experience, I think the number $5 an hour has been floated around a few times. That feels about right if you compare it to movies, for example, or if you compare it to other games. That's a reasonable amount of money. I think the problem with the Martian experience is its high price point. I mean, if it were a full-hour game, you'd be spending $60 for 1 hour of playtime. That's a lot of money. So I think we're still finding our way in that, and I think there'll be some experiences that are inherently open-ended, like Tilt Brush, for example. You can play Tilt Brush forever, just creating all these amazing experiences. How do you charge per hour for that? Well, you can't really. So you have to come up with a number. Anything that's not a fixed duration, like my games are kind of 40 minutes to an hour, play them once. Whereas Tilt Brush is, you know, buy it once, play it forever. So that's a different kind of experience. Pricing those is a lot harder. Google Earth just came out recently, Google Earth VR, and it's free. And you can spend hours just flying over the planet, looking at stuff. It's an awesome experience. I'm going to disagree with something you said earlier on. I think multi-user experiences are absolutely compelling, and much sooner than 2 years from now, I think they're going to become one of the dominant forms. And people spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours in that because the content there is other people who are endlessly interesting and fascinating to talk to.
It brings in a whole other aspect of the VR experience. Does anybody in the audience experience the AltSpace VR? Has anybody gone into that? I'd encourage everyone to take a look. The nice thing about it is it's cross-platform. So you can go in via your PC, you can go in via your mobile device, you can go in via a Samsung Gear VR or Google, and then you can go in for a more immersive experience like an HTC Vive. And it's able to kind of survive those mediums. And what it does is it renders you as an avatar in a bunch of different spaces as you go through. And one of the things I think that we begins to put into play is two things. One is agency. Can you feel like you're in another world? And then the other one, in terms of the immersion, level of immersion, is what do you, is there something to do in that world? I mean, Demir, when we were talking earlier on about the kind of the notion of where content development is going to go, how important is it to give people something to do when you transport them out of their current experience? And how do we get from where we've been in the past with the game interface, which is all about connection to a character, to going into an immersive environment where it's about the things that you experience in a rendered world or the presented world of a reality capture.
Well, this is we're seeing the biggest shortfall right now. That's actually quality of content. So I don't think it's even important if you have anything to do in this world. It doesn't really matter. Like you said, you can stare in the fireplace. If this is a cool fireplace that looks convincing, if I feel I'm there, I don't have to interact with anything. I could just sit there and watch this fireplace. So far, I didn't see the fireplace. I would sit down and watch for 20 minutes. Doesn't mean it's not doable, but we are not there. It kind of reminds me back in the days, probably early PlayStation 1, when everyone was moving towards 3D. But 3D looks extremely crappy. On arcades, when you have first games like Tekken 1 or Virtual Fighter, whatever, they look semi-decent because they have high frame rate. Everything that early on these platforms look really, really poorly. So 2D games look significantly better. But 3D added another level of gameplay or anything like that. I think we are at this stage right now when the games that are not VR still significantly better experience, especially when you can sit down and play it on your computer, on your machine. So that's what we're missing. We really need this killer content in order to get not even mass market VR, just to have more attraction to people. You will have this immediate experience that's really cool first time you see it, because you're going to find yourself in this virtual world that you didn't experience before. It's really good. You're going to love it. After 10 minutes, you're going to start cooling off. You already saw everything, like I did. I saw everything that's out there, and I still don't have a game that I can really sit down and play for hours, because there's nothing that's done well enough yet.
Right. I mean, how important do you feel, Keith, maybe address this, that the mobile devices that we carry in our pockets are a gateway to augmented reality experience, which will lead us down the path into virtual reality through Google Daydream? How important is it to kind of like be aware of the full ecosystem and the path of the user experience so that you can kind of build a groundswell of interest in the medium?
It is and it isn't. On one hand, I think it's really important to have the accessibility. Everybody, eventually, the whole goal is to have everybody with a mobile device who will actually be able to play or experience a VR experience. The problem with that, though, is that what people are going to be using mobile devices for is going to be completely different from what they use their PCs for. And as Bernie was saying earlier, we currently have these very expensive desktops that we have to set up in order to use that. Is that going to be a gateway necessarily? Probably not, because you've already made an investment into your phone, even though in most cases not up front. It is a long-term investment into that particular device. But then, you know, not everybody who has a phone is going to be relying on a PC. Most people, a lot of people I know now, don't even bother with getting a PC or even a laptop if they personally, because they can do everything on their mobile device. But as an experience that gets people into having a small experience that they want to, if they're interested and they want to get something more, then that's where mobile actually really gets interesting, because now we have quite a variety of different experiences that allow the users to experience virtual reality, whether it's 360 video, which is not VR, to anything else, that like games and so on out there, that allows you to go into these different realities and to try out different things. And then once you actually then, as a precursor, you feel, okay, my brain is ready for this, I'm good, I can do VR, then you can start getting into more complex experiences. In a way, it's kind of like the going from the Atari 2600 as mobile to going to a full-on console with a head-mounted display. There are wide differences, and it takes time to get some people in there, or you get some people who just go straight for the biggest fish and just want to get the big head-mounted display right away.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that the other issue, and I agree with you 100% on the issue of content. We need lots of content, but a lot of people don't want to invest in creating content until there's a larger installed base. And so it's a chicken and the egg problem. And that happened with every medium. I mean, television, for example. It took a long time before people started producing quality television programs because nobody had television sets. And nobody wanted to buy televisions until there was the content. So it is very much a chicken and the egg because developers, again, have to make a living. Now, certainly funding organizations like the OMDC can help with that, right? And CMF and things that provide development funds that will create the content that kickstart the industry. But really, everyone has to at some point bite the bullet and say, I'm going to develop content and trust that the market is going to be there.
One of the things that you look at, Rhonda, when you mentioned earlier about devices and people and what they carry into the museums, do you want to encourage people to utilize their mobile devices when they're in the museum environment, or do you want them to focus on what you're presenting?
A little of both. So we do have stuff. We have things we want to present to people. But one of the aspects we really haven't talked a lot about what we would do at the museum, we're trying to implement augmented reality. So this is still just in the development stage. We have the 3D scans. Mm-hmm. We're working on how to develop them in an app. But I like the idea of people going in with their own personal device. Our slogan is history in your hands. So this actually does put history in their hands. It's a more personal experience to walk up to an exhibit, see the actual object, and then be able to digitally hold it in your hand, manipulate it in your hand, turn it around. It's stagnant there. You can't see the other side. You can't see the bottom. You can do that in your own hand. So I think it is important, and it works very well in our environment to be able to provide an engageable tool of something that otherwise they don't necessarily get access to. We can also walk out. We call it the village. We have a village reconstruction next door to our site. It is the Lawson site. It was an Attawandaron village. It was a 1500s. We imagine it was probably occupied. About 2,000 people live there, over 35 longhouses. There's one longhouse in that village when you walk out to look at it. The village is archaeological. It's underground. I'd love to be able to walk out there with an iPad or a phone and be able to see that village in front of you. We can't recreate it. It's actually a protected site. It's recognized historic site, so we can't build on it any more than it's already built on. And a lot of it hasn't been excavated, so we can't touch it. But digitally, we could recreate that. So there's a lot of opportunity there for us, I think, to merge both physical and digital.
And if anyone lives in London, I would encourage them to check out the museum. I was there last week, and they have some really interesting exhibits. They have the HTC Vive and the Longhouse. I had not even heard of this place until I actually met Rhonda through this panel, and I went to check it out, and I recommend everyone at least learn that it's there and get the word out.
I think one of the things that you illustrate there, Rhonda, is that you can extend your experience from the physical into the digital by utilizing a device that everybody has.
Yes.
What would you give in terms of like the prospect for downloading that app? Do you want people to come with the app downloaded in advance? Are you going to give them Wi-Fi access so that they can easily download the app when they get to your museum? I mean, what are the considerations that you have to sort of think about in order to acquire that interaction?
Those are the exact things that we are trying to think about right now. So in terms of it's looking like Wi-Fi, you come in and you download the app there. You could come in with the app. Ideally, I'd like to see a takeaway. So that one of the challenges, people don't know the museum's there. And a challenge for any museum is once you go, that's it, out of mind. To be able to take away and have something you engage with later, that is important to us. That's valuable
souvenir.
To us. Yeah, a digital souvenir. So I'd like the ability to at least come away with some sorts of experience captured on a personal device. I'm not sure how we can get there yet. Our challenge is finding a way to develop these things that we have ideas for in our head. In a small museum in a small part of this town is particularly challenging.
Well, I'm sure that there are members of the audience here that are listening to you saying that you need a developer. I think the area of the proposition here for the audience now is you've heard us talk about the different experiences, what we think is current. We've focused very much on the virtual reality aspect of it. We touched on augmented reality. I know that there are members of the publishing and the music communities here in terms of like how understanding how to parlay that thread out into augmented reality and virtual reality opportunities. Now I wanted to cast it open to the audience and see what questions you may have for the panelists up here. If there's any particular area that you want to focus on, or if you have a general question, please fire away. Mark.
Hi, guys.
Yes, it's on.
Thanks for the super interesting talk. So I guess my question is primarily for Keith, because I know Keith is doing all the different VR platforms, but I guess it depends as well maybe for Bernie. So HTC Vive versus Oculus Rift is kind of the big question. There is PSVR now as well, but I'm curious from a technical standpoint, what have been the differences, the challenges, you know, what do you feel in your experience is the better platform to develop on? What's been, you know, from either on a controller standpoint or on an accessibility or usability standpoint?
Definitely from the usability standpoint, I find the Vive is better. However, from the usability standpoint of the motion controllers is the best for the Vive. You feel that one-to-one scale of movement. It has a room scale environment. Originally, the Oculus didn't, but now if you actually purchase yourself a couple of extra cameras, you can kind of mock up a room scale for the Oculus. So they're really close. It's like the difference between PS4 and Xbox One. Which one do you like? What flavor of the day? And we're going to see soon enough where there's already rumblings about the next HTC Vive, the Vive 2 or 2.0 or whatever they're going to call it. And then 6 months later, we're going to see an update on the Oculus. So they're going to be leapfrogging over each other, very similar to the console industry. In terms of the simplicity, like which one was easier to develop for? They were both pretty much the same. We're finding the difficulty was waiting for our touch controllers. We actually waited a while before we actually got ours from as a developer from Oculus. So not having access to those earlier on made a significant difference. And since we wanted to do all these demonstrations at Comic-Con, so it just made that decision to focus on the Vive first much easier in that regard. So in regards to which one we chose, there were a lot of reasons, but I still would have chosen the Vive first. But that's like choosing, you know, the biggest, baddest engine out there. And, you know, focusing, since we're also doing work on PlayStation, we also had limitation of access because of the earliness of the technology. So we had some limitations on that side. If I had my way, though, I would have started with PlayStation first because, like I said earlier, it's always easier to scale up than scale down.
Right. I guess I started with the Gear VR for my game because I knew it's the most challenging platform, right? If you can get it running on a mobile phone, it'll run fine on everything else. I agree with Keith's points about the Vive. Certainly the fact they were first out of the gate with motion controllers, things you hold in your hands, is a huge advantage. I can always port to the Oculus Rift with touch later on, but having those was a big advantage, absolutely.
So I have a question mostly for the game developers. And the question is about motion sickness. And what is the feedback you are getting from your users about motion sickness? And I will just talk a little second about myself. I'm on the extreme side. I do not get motion sickness in cars or buses, but in VR, if my viewpoint is moving while I am not, I get motion sickness immediately. Mm-hmm. And that actually, the Vive is the only system I can use because it has the one-to-one scale room right. tracking.
Certainly, I get motion sick in the real world, but not so much in VR because I'm careful to choose VR experiences that aren't going to make me sick. And you really have to be somewhat selective as a consumer and go, okay, if I'm going to ride a virtual roller coaster, well, people get sick on real-world roller coasters. So the better and more accurate the virtual one is, the more likely you are to get sick on that. And there are some guidelines in the industry for what to do and what not to do. You don't want to move the camera except under user control. In particular, you don't want to strafe, which means moving side to side. You don't want to have yaw rotation. There are a lot of things you kind of want to avoid if possible. Now, some games require that you do that, and that's fine, but you have to give people a chance to get acclimated to those things. Fortunately, what I'm working on are room escape games. You don't have to move around very far. They're smallish rooms. There are a number of them that are connected to each other. Also giving people an advisory saying, this game is very comfortable. This game is challenging for anyone who gets motion sick. So they can make an informed decision going into it as to whether to play it or not is part of the answer. Keith probably has more experience in this area than I do, so I'll defer to him on this.
So our superhero game is basically an open world action RPG. Something that we knew was going to be extremely challenging right from the get-go because having an open world environment, allowing a full 360 degree rotation in there, we're honing on the controls constantly, and we're always having that sort of difficulty on that end. However, fortunately, we had a decent set of controls set up very, very early on, and we had over 2,000 people try out the game over the course of the summer. So we had a lot of testers go through. And there's different types of sickness. So it's not just motion sickness. There's VR sickness. There's people who, as soon as they put on the headset, their brain says, nope, that's not real, and they got to take it off or they're going to be sick. There's so many different types. You have to be aware. So doing any kind of analytics on the physiological reactions that people are having to the experience is a great way to figure out what type of a player that person is. Like Bernie was saying that like certain places are actually indicating like low level of difficulty or engaging in any kind of sickness, motion sickness. So our game Bloxic VR, virtually anybody can go in there. I actually have a couple of people in my office I call my canaries. They're the canaries in the coal mine. As soon as they do something for more than 5 minutes, they're going to be sick. So we get them in just to test things out a little bit from time to time. They're like kamikaze
That's
pilots.
That's a heck of a job.
Are you okay? Yeah. So we get branded bags and everything.
Now, Keith, you've been to the VR arcade in Waterloo.
Yeah.
They claim they've had thousands of people through with no physical sickness problems whatsoever.
Yeah.
They've probably curated those 27 games,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. There's a lot of games out there right now that actually, unless if you're in a standing environment or a seated environment, as soon as you get into that room scale, there's so many more options in order to make people sick. So there is a lot of content, even out on the Steam platform, for instance, that is very nauseating.
We have a question in the audience.
Thank you. We've talked largely about entertainment and a little bit about education. What other applications do you see for VR coming in the future?
Health, lots of health.
Training
is a big one. Simulations. There's so many different areas where we can actually start getting people. I met somebody who actually is doing one of the biggest problems that people have is that if they go through any kind of physiotherapy, as soon as they leave the physiotherapist, their physiotherapy stops, which normally they give you lots and lots of work to do afterwards. My wife, for instance, was involved in a pretty significant car accident almost 2 years ago. And broke her ankle. So she has to constantly do physio. And a lot of people just don't find it engaging. It's boring. It's exercise. They don't want to do it. But these guys actually created a very simple system of you were basically working on a like the ISS or something, the International Space Station. You had to raise, it was a shoulder work, so you had to raise this bar a certain height, and then the more you could actually move your shoulder, the higher and higher you would actually move this bar. And it was all for, you know, contextually something to do with the space station that you're on. So it was a simple way of getting somebody in VR to focus on physiotherapy. And it totally made sense when you saw it, but nobody would think VR and physio, that goes together. Nobody would think that.
There's also been a lot of good work done on things like treating phobias, treating PTSD, that kind of thing.
And then in the military sector, within simulations, there's been a lot of work done on synthetic environments for a long time. What the really important part of the fact that domestic systems offer is the fact that you can have a very state-of-the-art training facility where flight simulations can be done. But it's not about so much the quality of the experience but the repetition. So if somebody is going to learn a task, the more that they do it, and the more the familiar that they become with it. And now we have the opportunity for somebody to go to a full-blown flight simulator with an Airbus cockpit and see and experience what it feels like to fly that plane. But then they can go home with that same experience on a micro scale and fly that same sequence of events, experience the same things again and again at their home in their own environment. That's one component. The other area that's really interesting is how big data, artificial intelligence, machine learning, all those things are components of augmented reality and virtual reality. And the Internet of Things and the presence of augmented reality on mobile devices gives us an opportunity to take data
from real live feeds, bring it to your handset in your hand, and put the world in your hand. So it's so there's a company called PTC out of Boston that has a platform called ThingWorks that bought Vuforia, which is one of the main augmented reality visual recognition platforms last year. They have integrated for field technicians the opportunity to take a mobile device, just as simple as a lap, as a just like an iPad, and have that tablet and be in front of a piece of machinery that has a fault in it, to be able to scan that machinery, identify where the fault lies, to unpack a virtual computer-aided design of that object, identify where the issue is, be guided how to fix it, and then run a diagnostic. So this improves field efficiency. But what it also does, it means that same task can now be performed by somebody who understands what they're doing, and it doesn't require a technician to be shipped out. It also can be done remotely. So you begin to understand that through augmented reality and virtual reality, there is a path towards aiding enterprise, solving solutions, and addressing problems. The more that we begin to do that, and we begin to show how augmented reality and virtual reality actually have the way to extend experiences and solve problems, the more present it will be.
Another area that I can actually speak to is data visualization. That's going to be another area where I think virtual reality is going to come in very handy, where you can actually manipulate data in real time, looking at it in a pseudo-physical format and in a way that isn't just plots on a graph. There's many different ways to actually do that now in VR. And I think that's going to be one of the bigger ways. And to actually go past on your point, I can say, like, a lot of the home renovations I've done in the past have been done by, okay, I'm a dummy, and what's on YouTube here? So now I can actually have more mechanical-based applications in VR to take a look at things like home renovation or, you know, how do I do an oil change on my car? And actually seeing these things, and you can physically get underneath a car in VR, and that's where things are actually really cool. Rather than looking at just a video and trying to figure out what that's like, you can actually do these actual things, and that's where I think a lot of more training and opportunity based, both on a personal scale, corporate scale, even with government, I think there's a lot of opportunities way outside of entertainment. It's just that entertainment's the first place where people are going to be looking at.
I mean, there's also things like architectural walkthroughs, interactive design, language learning. I mean, the possibilities really are endless.
Do we have any? We have time for one more question. If there's anybody in the audience that would like to, can we be behind? Do we have the microphone down the front here? I mean, I think one of the things that's really fascinating about this area is that as you begin to unmap technology in general, healthcare, you mentioned, there is an initiative being run by CAMH right now where they understand that mental illness can be impacted by augmented reality and virtual reality by developing scenarios and role-playing. And I think this is a really interesting area. We have a question.
Going back to the problem of chicken and egg, and you know, not being able to develop content because there's not a large install base, I had a question like comparing the rise of VR to the rise of the internet. When the same situation was happening in the early internet age, there were a few niche markets that were, you know, targeting specific people before the install base was big, and one of them in entertainment was adult entertainment, and they developed a lot of technologies that really helped boost the internet and grow it as an entire industry. Do you see the same trend in VR? Do you have a lot of adults?
Oh yes.
If you were to, like, what proportion is that? Like, out of all the entertainment content that's produced in VR today, is it like 10%, 50%, 80%?
It's difficult to measure. I mean, how many of all the video content that's produced, how much of it is porn? Who knows? It's hard to really get numbers on that.
But significantly smaller than people think. Usually, it was always saying, you know, X percent of the search on internet are porn, but it's actually not true, not even close to that. I just read some article about a month ago. They're saying, I think Pornhub or something, they have about 10 million search per day, and this is what's happening in Google for other stuff per minute or something like that. So it is really... not as significant as you might.
And it tends to be the same users over and over and over again. Probably just the one guy, really. You know, just click, click, click.
Just can't find the motivation.
And as I understand also, the what's interesting about video content in 360 is the technology of the cameras. So we started out with camera technology that was capable of capturing 360 video very simply. The frame rate wasn't very good. The resolution wasn't very high. If you go onto YouTube 360, you can see a lot of content on there that gives you an idea of what the potential is. But then you have to be able to direct the user. And in cinematic content, if you're giving away the narrative and because you now have the opportunity for the audience to be able to look anywhere, they don't have to look where the action is, you need to understand that creating a construct and a storyboard and maintaining that narrative and experience is quite different from a linear format. So one of the things that you can maybe I would suggest if anybody's in this area that they do is Deep Ink. They're a production studio out of Toronto. They did a really amazing 360 video project last year with the Canada Space Agency, and they created this experience called The Edge of Space. And essentially what it is a meteorological balloon with four very high-quality digital SLRs that were suspended for it to capture the complete 360 environment as it rose to the edge of space. So you get this ascendancy feel. That you are actually ascending in this balloon above the planet. Now, what's interesting is that they were inspired to do this by a very historic French filmmaker who created this experience for a world fair in Paris, where he went up in a balloon and he captured it, and then he rendered it out inside a dome. And so you could go to the World's Fair and you could see this projected onto the inside of the dome. And this was like at the turn of the century. So there are ways to create environments and experiences that we can borrow from in the past that will allow us to adore to the future. And I think this is where the excitement really begins to build. So thank you very much for your attention today. We will be here as panelists for a little bit. If you have any particular questions you'd like to address one-on-one, please feel free. But thank you again to the OMDC, to the London Economic Development Corporation, to the City of London, to everybody for attending today. It's been a great pleasure.